I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Leszek Zawistowski. He is author of the new memoir, Children and Fish Don't Talk, Adventures with Nazis, Communists, and the Metropolitan Opera. And the memoir was written in collaboration with his daughter, Monique Zawistowski, and his wife, Toni Rapport Zawistowski, both of whom are also joining us. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you have written, Leszek, a memoir about your life that began in 1938, and you essentially lived the first 7 years of your life in Poland in a series of almost unbelievable war zones. What was it like for you to revisit that? I mean, so many people kind of forget about war or put it out of their mind, and here you are writing this memoir.
That memory of the Nazi period, when, unfortunately, into which I was born, it's you cannot erase. You don't talk about casually, but it's going to stay with you, especially when you are a very young child and you are very impressionable. Children, young children, maybe they cannot express themselves in their age, but they are very observant and they have that very clear brain capacity and the imprint of their experiences from that early years stays for the rest of their lives.
Now, you were born with a Jewish mother and a Polish Catholic aristocratic father.
That's correct.
And both of those lineages brought you to some pretty horrible experiences during World War II.
Because of my mother, who was extremely smart and very courageous and very clever, I would say. So that helped me growing up, I would say, survive. But from my father's point, because he was Polish nobility and grew up in very primitive territories of Poland, on the very eastern part of Poland, on the border of Białoruś, and being conservative Catholic, because that's everybody was that region, so he was very strict. That's the reason the title of that book is Children and Fish Don't Talk, because that was his way to raise me, and I needed to get the permission to open my mouth.
So your older brother was taken away. The other two siblings barely survived just because of a combination of luck and your mother's ability. And the survival ability of both of your parents is unbelievable. I mean, you're reading the story and you just can't believe that one horrifying event after another happens and they just keep surviving. But you then, at the age of 4, were, even though both of your parents were still alive, you were essentially orphaned. What happened?
Because after my oldest brother was taken by Gestapo away from our apartment in Warsaw, so my father and mother realized that we are on the list, even that my mother lived with a very prominent Catholic, and herself she didn't go to temple or wasn't really religious, but the evil bureaucracy of the Nazis, they found out the Jewish origins up to third generations and maybe farther, and that's what they took my oldest brother. So they realized that we need to disperse because they're going to hunt us, especially me and my older brother, and we will face the same fate what my brother did. And that's the reason I couldn't find through my research which organization took me away from my parents. I presumed it was Red Cross, and with the false paper, Christian papers, baptized, and they sent me as an orphan for adaptation. That's the way I could survive the war.
And you ended up in what sounds at first like a kind of fairy tale situation, living with a tailor at the edge of a village with another little girl. But one of the things that's really interesting about your book is village life is not so beautiful.
No. It's a hard, and the people very rough. Those people, again, their daily life is to survive for another day. And especially in the wartime, because from all the sides, from Nazis, Wehrmacht soldiers would come into the village and taking everything possible because they need to supplies to eat. And the underground partisans were doing the same thing. So those people caught, like, you know, in impossible situations. So everything was secret and hiding and rough and distrust. Nobody trusted anybody.
One of the things that one is really struck by, and this is the story of so many people, I think, who grew up in Nazi Europe and then ended up in the Soviet zone, is you go essentially from Hitler to Stalin, and in some ways those are kind of two sides of the same coin.
My opinion, and from my experiences and from my background, I equal Nazis and Stalinists, communists, equal. They're both evil, totalitarian regimes, and only always people saying, but there must be difference. I said, yes, there was some difference. The Nazis, if you didn't collaborate with them or if they felt like eliminate you, they just simply killed you. Communists, during the Stalin era, they didn't arrest you. They didn't put you really in the for treason or for anti-communist activity. You simply didn't show up at home. You disappear. That was different methods, but the same. Stalin managed to kill his own people and other nationals like Poles and Czechs and Germans, approximately 30 million people, which is horrendous.
And so here you are growing up under all of this, and you come to play the cello, which then became your life's work.
That's right. That became my life companion until I met my wife.
Who played the violin, and the rest
is
history. But how did you start playing, and how did that become such a major part of your being?
At the post-war in Poland, in Warsaw, it was incredible poverty. Parents, you have one or two if you're lucky, they work from morning to late night to survive. So in that time, the Catholic Church, like in Warsaw, my neighborhood, took the role of helping the society and taking children. So the children from school directly went to the church, and at the church they got supervise their homework. They will participate in the sport activities, musical activities. So I was, as a little boy, 7, 8 years boy, I was in the boys' choir, and the priest, who was a very fine musician, pianist and violinist, well-trained musically, and he discovered that I have that gift, a musical gift. So one day before the major church holidays, they have little baroque ensemble, and they were all very old, retired people playing their instruments, and poor cellist just passed away. So the priest put his cello in between my legs. The cello was bigger than me, and said, "I'm going to teach you because I need in 3 months somebody who will play the Baroque continuo." And that's what I started as the cellist.
We're talking to Leszek Zawistowski about his new memoir, Children and Fish Don't Talk. Monique is joining us by telephone. Now, you are the daughter of Tony and Leszek, who are here in the cafe with us. Did you hear some of these stories when you were a girl?
I did. I mean, my older sister Tanya and I would be glued to these stories, unfortunately, only at dinner parties or the occasional family dinner. They were very ephemeral. And I think it's a common reaction among kids who are a generation or two separated from war. They're hungry to hear more and to connect the dots. And that was certainly the case with me. He'd tell these wild stories about being kidnapped by Cossacks. And, you know, it seemed like a romantic fairy tale. And I always wanted to piece together the whole story. And it seemed remarkable that this man who was raising his American kids in a suburban home had such a dangerous, action-packed background. It was all otherworldly, and I always wanted to write the story down.
And so how did the three of you come to actually do this memoir writing project?
Well, I think actually this project was conceived when Monique was 11 years old and was listening to her father at the dinner table tell stories. And on reflection, I realized that I think probably the telling of the stories at the dinner table was a reaction to Leszek's time as a child when there was food on the table at dinner time post-war, and there wasn't much, when he was not allowed to talk and his father wagged his finger at him and his brother and said, "Children and fish don't talk." And so Leszek would tell these incredible stories, which of course to a child, and as I said, Monique was 11 at the time, seemed very fantastical and almost unreal, but she's the historian of the family, and she's always been fascinated, and I think has always wanted her father to tell his story. And Leszek is a quite remarkable storyteller, and obviously this is his life. And I believe that that's how it evolved all those years ago. But I played the role of an observer as well as a participant. We have been married for 45 years, and so it's been an incredible and fascinating journey for me. And so how it started, I mean, Monique really twisted his arm, and finally in the...
Oh, yeah. For 3 decades.
Yes, it was... He had a hard time escaping that, and of course with my encouragement. And so the process unfolded in a very interesting, I think, way. Leszek would lock himself up in a room in our house with a tape recorder, and he actually told his story in... He took notes. He prepared himself with notes.
In the Polish, English, Esperanto.
And these tapes, every... he would... When a sort of episode was finished, he would send the tape to Monique. She transcribed it word for word onto the computer, would email the transcript to me, and she and I would begin sort of, you know, rewriting and writing.
Did all your children grow up speaking Polish?
They, because we were both performers and working in the Metropolitan Opera, so, and having 4 children, so we always have live-in person with us. And that person was Polish, so it was necessity. So the children learned Polish from their nanny, and Tony learned Polish to be able to communicate. But I was extremely afraid to put my story on the paper, because I wasn't English educated. I didn't go to English school. I had my own education university in Poland. And I couldn't, because I was like an export Polish artist, the privileged class in Poland, and sent to perform all over the world, I was afraid, was sort of impossible to take in Poland English lessons because there would be suspicion.
Right.
So everything was, you know, like you said, the people were watching and spying on you. But one day, by accident, I read the biography of Joseph Conrad. And Joseph Conrad was a Polish. He left Poland when he was 13 years old. And his English was a third language. The primary language was Polish, Russian, and English was learned in London. And to the rest of his life, he spoke with an accent like me. He was a big misspeller. And all of his books, I learned, to my surprise, he dictated to his secretaries.
Is that right?
So that gave me so much encouragement. And I said, damn it, I'm going to do the same. I have the voice-activated tape recorders. But it really didn't work, just tape recorder. I needed to write my thoughts. And, of course, I get at home Tony, who is just amazing English-educated person and a fantastic editor, and Monique. So between two of them was just fabulous.
And Monique, I must say, because she probably won't say this about herself, but Monique is a documentary film editor and works weaving stories together. That is her profession, and she's right. An amazingly creative writer. And so we performed three different roles.
Very, very interesting. We're talking to Leszek, Monique, and Tony Rapport-Zawistowski about the memoir Children and Fish Don't Talk. So going back to your life, I mean, there are so many stories that we could tell and that I really encourage people to actually pick up a copy of this book and read it, because there are so many stories of brutality that are almost difficult to read, especially if you grew up in the United States and you haven't been exposed to that kind of stuff and your bar for what counts as really awful is very low compared to what people who've been through war zones like that, like you have been exposed to, and some of the things are too grisly to even talk about on the radio. But the war is over, you're playing the cello, and you get the chance to study with Rostropovich.
Yes, my unbelievable idolized musician, and he was amazing artist, amazing cellist. At that time, he was the greatest player in the world, but he was same time extremely warm, supportive, and lovable person. I will compare him to another personality, a person, musician, whom we met was Leonard Bernstein, Lenny Bernstein. I mean, when you greet Rostropovich, you didn't say, hello, maestro or professor. He always needed to have big hug and kiss and personal questions. And you never, being in front or working with that man, I never was intimidated.
And yet you didn't ultimately get to study with him. Why not?
Why not? Because my main professor from Warsaw Music Academy, Warsaw University, was very, because I was his best student, he was very possessive and very jealous. And he, wicked way, arranged an audition for Warsaw National Philharmonic and brought me to the rehearsal with my cello, which I was puzzled. And the director that time was Witold Robicki. He asked me to play. So I played. And after I finished playing, he said, so I see you next week at the rehearsal, blah, blah, blah. So I told him, no, maestro, I want to study still. I'm going to, I have invitation to study with Rostropovich in Moscow, and he said, "No, you're going to play Warsaw Philharmonic, and if you so stupid, if you don't agree, so perhaps you're never going to play again." So it was like, "Oh my God, they're going to break my fingers or whatever," because that was the, you know, era what we live.
Well, and that story, I mean, it really struck me, because being a cellist and being threatened by the conductor of an orchestra who says, essentially, "I will break your fingers if you don't do what I want you to do, and if you go and study with Rostropovich," that is such a clear and sad example of what war does to civil society.
And also what that totalitarian political system's doing to society and people, which you, as an American, and my family, you never experienced that, because whatever people complaining about this and that politics, and but it's still the greatest democracy in the world, and you can express yourself, and you can do whatever you want in your life, and nobody is going to tell you what you should do and what you should say or what you should not say, and you're not afraid to be punished for that. One of the reasons that, including me, that so many people from all over the world want to come and live in this country, not for economic reasons. That is a totally misconception. Majority because they want that freedom, and they want that their children will grow up in that kind of free society. And this is just almost the last bastion in the world with that free society.
I wanted to say it was so interesting for me, of course, not only as a wife, but as an observer, as I said before, to watch Leszek's emotional reactions when he emerged from this room in which he sat for perhaps 6 hours a day for quite a long time. I mean, maybe it was a year and a half, 2 years, telling his story. And the range of emotions was amazing. Often he would come out laughing because he would have told an amusing story that, coming from someone who endured what he did through his life, amazing that he retained a quite remarkable sense of humor, and he's a very funny storyteller. Other times he would come out crying, and I found, in fact, that not so often, but there was the occasional story that he had buried from childhood that was really too painful to reconnect with. And you've read some of those stories in the book, and as you mentioned, some too horrifying to describe on the radio, but quite cathartic, I would imagine, and relieving that he was able to remember them, able to describe them, put them in the book, and relieve himself somewhat of this burden that he had been carrying around.
Did you experience it that way, as a relief from a burden?
When I started to write, and the first days, first weeks almost, I suddenly faced with that memory and the truth, and I was very often almost like motionless for long periods of time, and almost like in the meditative state of my mind, and it was like self-imposed psychotherapy,
right.
and it was so liberated, and it was just sometimes, like Tony said, I was teary and crying, or I couldn't speak for a long time after, because my mind was like so intense, locked in on center things. And next day I needed to just open and release. And I think that the experience of writing this book was amazing. I recommend that every person should write it.
Yeah, and especially your particular story of both Nazism and then communism and then defecting to the United States. It's an important story to hear.
Well, I think it originally began as a document to leave our children. And I don't know, Monique can express this herself, but I think perhaps that was even in Monique's mind. Let us all have the history written down. And from that, it really did evolve in something a lot greater than that.
I mean, it was, I think, for posterity for a very short time. And once we started getting into chapter 2 or chapter 3, and my daughter turned 4 at the same time that we were writing the pages that Dad was a 4-year-old orphan of war, we realized that the story had broader relevance and it was going to be hopefully something bigger.
But from that period of the European history, world history, I think that my story is not highly unusual. There were probably thousands of children like me and families who went to that unbelievable horrors, trying to survive. And we are basically humans. We are great survivors, you know, and we're trying.
Well, the story of your father is a really amazing story, both of survival and of what it takes to break a person. I mean, he was an extraordinarily courageous man who survived World War II and fought and helped a lot of people. And then, to everybody's great surprise, came back, had a glorious reunion with his family, with your mother, with you, and then was taken away again. First, he was fighting against the Nazis, then the communists took him away. And he went to the Gulag for 3 years and came back a different man.
Totally different. Because he never talked about his experiences in Gulag. He was mute. And that happened, I found out, because I met several, including here in Santa Fe, people who survived Nazi death camps. Like in Auschwitz or other, those awful places, and they survived. And it's interesting, they are like my father. When I try to talk to them about and trying to get some information and trying to sort of encourage them, please write that story, put on the paper, or just dictate this now with modern world. You can just dictate to tape recorder and transcribe after. They don't know. They don't want to go to that past. They're afraid. They don't want to hurt themselves again.
Yeah.
But as Leszek says, there are so many people who went through the Holocaust. Of course, the survivors are dying off. But there is so much history that remains. But in Leszek's case, I think the story is much broader than that, because this book encompasses his time in the United States, fighting for his green card and fighting for his citizenship and playing in the Metropolitan Opera and living through the McCarthy era and coming in contact with a completely different world, a much more modern world. So I think the story is more than a Holocaust story.
Absolutely. Now, how did you end up deciding to actually defect to the United States? You had a beautiful apartment, you were living in Warsaw,
Oh, yes.
You had a job, and you were really among the cultural elite of your city and of your country.
Because of my family background, how I grew up in the family, and like I mentioned in the book, the whole family daily at night listened to radio, Voice of America, Radio Free Europe. And my experiences when I was growing up, like the experience which I mentioned in the book, when we were at school, in high school that was, when Stalin died in 1953, and they herded us into the ensemble to mourn the great leader's death, and 4 hours, and the little kids are, you know, 16, 17, 15, standing shoulder to shoulder, and they started to play games and so, and one of my classmates burst into laughter, and we never saw him again or his family. They just took him away, and that was the fear of that. And growing up, and when you become a student, and you become more liberal, and you read a lot literature, and study, and you form your own ideas, and you very courageous in that age. I don't know if I will have that courage to the fact that I was 50, but I was only 26, just after my getting my master's degree in university, and also having the privilege to be sent to travel to the West. So when I went to London to play concert, or Paris, or Switzerland, and I saw the difference coming back to Poland, I was so miserable.
What was
living
the difference?
Poland. First thing, that when you come to the Polish airport, Warsaw airport, how you were treated by the customs and securities. Second, when basic things like those days, like getting one banana or an orange or something, when so that you go to the market and they have that, so that lines for half mile, and they give you one, and
right.
And it just like, and you like it. So it was economically was so depressed, and people live such a poor lives, and like I said before, and you were afraid to look over your shoulder because you don't know who is looking at you or listening to you. That's, you know, it's oppressed, very oppressed society.
Right. In other words, living in fear and tension.
That's
virtually
right.
All the time.
That's right.
Now, we're talking to Leszek Zawistowski and his daughter Monique and wife Toni about the memoir Children and Fish Don't Talk. Defecting to the United States, it's not, I mean, you were there on tour, and in theory you can just walk out of your hotel room and defect, but it's not that easy.
Not that simple. I thought when I was in Poland that is going to be so simple. I just walk and just say hello and I'm here. Not really. And I defected in 64. And first I was planning to defect to Italy in 1959, but it took some preparations and thinking, and when I defected, there was suddenly, which I wrote in the book, there was so many obstacles, and the first thing I didn't think about legal. I was just practical things. Okay, I played my last concert at the Carnegie Hall, and tomorrow I want to be free. But where am I going to sleep? Where am I going to go? How and what? And the fear of the administrative authorities of the Warsaw Philharmonic, they were watching us. There were always few secretaries, which we know they were just, you know, secret police and so, if watching us and so. And so that was quite trying. But again, you couldn't, as American, if you like to defect to Poland, let's say, like an abstract, it wouldn't happen like happened to me, the fact in New York. People were so supportive, so friendly, and just was like amazing. Everybody was reaching to help me.
Now, the story of, first of all, your defection. I mean, I was on the edge of my seat reading this. And then the story of being taken away by immigration before you had a proper visa, and then giving this speech, this impassioned speech about your whole entire life, including some of the things we've talked about on this show, to an immigration judge who then let you stay based entirely on this true dramatic performance that you gave, is reason enough for people to pick up the book. But I wanted to ask you, because I want to make sure we talk about this before you go, how did the two of you meet?
Well,
great story.
It's a beautiful love story.
It's a great, if I can not cry in the middle of it. I came to New York after living in London for a year as a Fulbright scholar and was freelancing. And I had auditioned for Leopold Stokowski for the American Symphony.
Now, you were a violinist.
I was a violinist. And, of course, having no idea that there was a very handsome, sexy cellist who had also auditioned for Stokowski and who was also in the American Symphony. And I came to my first rehearsal. And I came having played a lot of chamber music throughout my life, solo playing as well, not too much orchestral playing. And Leszek, of course, had been playing with the Warsaw Philharmonic for 6 years. And on the stands in front of us was Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe Suite, which I had never played. So I sat down and was very studious. I was on the first stand of violins, and this handsome cellist was on the first stand of cello. So we were not too many feet apart from each other, but of course total strangers.
But we were facing each other.
Yes, exactly. And I was trying to learn the music, practice quickly, warm up before the rehearsal began. And somehow after the rehearsal began, and the conductor was Ernest Ansermé, he was a guest conductor, and he came very, very old man at that time, and not a whole lot of energy or spunk, but still, I was on the edge of my seat, having to sight read this music. And I found these pair of blue eyes staring at me, not looking at his music at all. And I became increasingly uncomfortable, and I thought I was doing something wrong. And anyway, the first half of the rehearsal passed and came to the intermission when we all went to our respective cases to put our instruments down and have a little rest and glass of water. And Leszek approached me, and he had a little tiny book in his hand. I quickly realized that it was a Polish-English dictionary, but of course at first I didn't know. And he was flipping the pages of this little book very quickly, and he looked up at me and he said, "I feel," and then he's flipping more pages, "lousy." And I thought, oh my goodness, who is this fellow who is telling me that he feels lousy? Well, it turned out, first of all, that was his way of apologizing for having distracted me. Second of all, it was my birthday. And the rest is history, and 5 months later we were engaged, and it was the greatest birthday present, of course, I could have possibly been given.
So how did you get involved with the Metropolitan Opera?
I got finally, because I auditioned for Stokowski, and I didn't have my still immigration papers. And without immigration papers, you cannot have be a union member. And as a musician working in New York, probably through United States, to work, you need to have union papers, members of the musicians' union. And so when I played for Stokowski, the audition, and he engaged me as the co-principal in his orchestra, I felt like jumping out of his window on Fifth Avenue. I was so incredible. And my attorney asked Stokowski, But he doesn't have union papers, so he picked up the phone, called the president of the union, and next day I had a union card. It was amazing, amazing. That's what I love about America. And little corruption doesn't hurt. And so I knew that the manager, orchestra manager of the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra was a Polish violinist, ex. And so I went to Metropolitan Opera and talked to him, and he said, show me your union card. I cannot listen to you or talk to you without your union card. So I had that union card, and the rest was history. I played the audition, they hired me, and after hired me as the substitute first. And when the opening of the new house at Lincoln Center in 1966 happened, the big, great grand gala of the new Metropolitan Opera, unfortunately, one of the cellists just before, like month before, passed away. So they had open audition, and I took that audition. And I was already in New York Philharmonic in the finals, as the finalist for New York Philharmonic job. And I took that audition in the Met, and that was the best thing I did in my life. And the Metropolitan Opera was extremely good for me, extremely good for both of us. And I gave a chance to continue playing our chamber music, and of course was extremely well compensated. We were, and it was like a big family, and I loved that job. And I was with the Metropolitan Opera for 36 years.
And you also?
Yes, 35 years for me. And there's no question that for the two of us to work together was extraordinary. And we actually were the first married couple in the orchestra. That, of course, has changed dramatically today. But at that time, that was not met with so much glee amongst some of our colleagues. But nonetheless, we felt very fortunate. We were indeed. And we had four children while both playing in the orchestra.
And you were one of the first women in the orchestra.
I was the fourth woman to be hired for that orchestra. And at that time in 1968, the New York Philharmonic was yet to hire even one woman. Again, that has the change is looking around the membership of orchestras today.
And now it's like half. 50% of the orchestras, both orchestras, the Metropolitan Opera and Philharmonic, they are ladies.
Right. Didn't that change when they started doing blind auditions? They would have a curtain so
you couldn't
see whether it was a male or female.
That's right.
Playing.
Absolutely. The Met auditions were very, very strict. Not at the time that I auditioned. There was no screen then. But shortly thereafter, we started that, and from that day on, it was strictly enforced to this day. As a matter of fact, women who came to the audition arrived in high heels, had to take them off.
That's right. So they couldn't be recognized that it's a woman walking on the heels.
Very, very interesting. So you have now written this memoir, and I wanted to ask you, I mean, how did you end up in Santa Fe after all those years in New York?
Metropolitan Opera, for 2 months of the summer, it's closed, the season. So it was fabulous.
As an opera house.
As the opera house. So we could go to play music festivals like Santa Fe, let's say, different summer festivals. And always we took vacation going to Europe, especially to like Italy or south of France. We loved that. And 25 years ago, one of the friends from Metropolitan Opera, who has a house in Santa Fe, invited us to Santa Fe. And we came here, and we were just, taken over by Santa Fe. Like, my God, this is like American Provence. We love here. And especially over the years, because for 15 years we were, it's summertime, we were renting houses, and we met so many people, and I, for me, Santa Fe is not the beauty of the territory, the mountains, the culture, the people, the variety of people, the interesting people from all aspects of life, politics, culture, business, and they living in such a wonderful harmony, and it's so fascinating. Over the time we started to come to Santa Fe, which is now over 25 years, there's almost every time that we invited some dinner party, we're meeting some another fascinating person.
Monique, did you grow up playing music?
I didn't, ironically, no. I think that both my parents thought it was too much pressure to put on their children, so we never studied music.
I have my little silly joke. When people ask me, you are very successful musicians, you or your wife, and how come none of your children is a musician? So my answer, silly answer, is always, do I look like a child abuser?
Now, do you two still play?
We don't. We were so fulfilled throughout our careers, both before meeting and after with the Metropolitan Opera. And it was actually for me when I moved to Santa Fe and people asked that question, do you still play, don't you, for your pleasure? And it was a difficult, people's responses I found a little bit troubling, because most people would be shocked and say, well, but once a musician, always a musician, how could you not play? And we both came to the same conclusion on reflection, that we had such a reward throughout our professional lives, and yet there was so much in life that we wanted to learn about and wanted to pursue.
Yeah.
The only way, of course, to maintain an artistic level is to practice every day. We went down different paths, and we basically really reinvented ourselves.
Leszek Zawistowski is author of the memoir Children and Fish Don't Talk, Adventures with Nazis, Communists, and the Metropolitan Opera. The memoir was written in collaboration with his daughter Monique Zawistowski and his wife Toni Rapport Zawistowski. I want to thank all of you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you. Wonderful.